This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with two guests about current Deputy Director of the CIA, Gina Haspel.
She's known by CIA agents as Bloody Gina, and it's likely that she's going to be the next head of the CIA.
The National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild recently filed a complaint challenging DHS's termination of temporary protected status for Haitians.
Now, we suspect Trump doesn't like Haitians in this country and would prefer Norwegians. But my Norwegian friends, and I've got a lot of them because I'm from Wisconsin, say that their relatives in Norway say that they would never come here.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Nazi generals and Nazi leaders were prosecuted at the end of World War II for war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide. These crimes were incorporated into international law. The chief prosecutor at Nuremberg was Robert Jackson, a U.S. Supreme Court judge. The Nazis defended themselves by arguing that they were just following orders. This defense was deemed unavailing. In many cases, they were found guilty and sentenced to lengthy prison terms or hung. We said that the War Crimes Tribunal at Nuremberg was not merely victor's justice, but that the principles it followed would be universal and applied in the future to all countries, including the USA. And indeed, the United States signed on to the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture and incorporated both of these crimes and the concept of universal jurisdiction into our law. Gina Haspel has just been nominated by Trump to head the CIA. She is a war criminal. She violated both international and national law by running a black site secret detention center in Thailand where men were tortured. Although there were several court orders that the evidence of the torture be preserved, Gina Haspel had the videotapes of torture destroyed. John Brennan, Obama's ex-head of the CIA, who was involved in the torture program, recently came to her defense, stating that she was just following orders. The Nazi defense. Trump supports torture. He believes that torture works. This is both immoral and untrue. He says he is for waterboarding and worse. He now has a subordinate with whom he is in agreement. Obama refused to prosecute the lawbreakers. Instead, he threw CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou in prison for 2 years for disclosing American torture. He said we must look forward, not backward. This greenlighted what is going on now with Haspel. Michael Ratner warned us about this eventuality. The European Center for Human and Constitutional Rights may seek Haspel's arrest if she goes to Germany. Such is the irony of history that the German fascist government that perpetuated the greatest crimes against humanity has now been superseded by an American government which condones and is perpetuating them as well. We speak today with attorney Katie Gallagher of the Center for Constitutional Rights. She is currently litigating cases on torture. Attorney Gallagher is a senior staff attorney at the center. She works on universal jurisdiction and international criminal law cases involving U.S. and foreign officials and torture and other war crimes and cases involving private military corporations and torture at Abu Ghraib. But first, we speak with ex-CIA agent John Kiriakou. He's the author of the memoir, Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. Kiriakou spent 15 years working for the CIA, including the period following September 11, 2001, when the United States was attacked. The next year, he was invited to be certified in enhanced interrogation techniques, but he said no, rightly recognizing it was a sanction of torture. He was privy to all the details of the American torture program and personally knew Gina Haspel. In 2007, when ABC News asked him to rebut charges that he tortured an Al-Qaeda prisoner, he went on the air to disclose the details about the American torture policy. For this, the CIA had him tried and convicted. He spent 23 months in prison.
John, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Current Deputy Director of the CIA, Gina Haspel, had run a secret torture prison. What exactly do we know about what she did with respect to rendition and torture?
We don't know very much specifically, but we can make some assumptions and draw some conclusions. When Gina Haspel was assigned to the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, it was as the chief of staff to the CTC's notorious director, Jose Rodriguez. As chief of staff, her job would have been to run the day-to-day operation of CTC. In that capacity, she would have had direct knowledge of and direct authority over the CIA's rendition program.
Let's briefly talk about enhanced interrogation techniques. Can you remind our listeners what some of the enhanced interrogation techniques were that the CIA used against Arabs and Muslims?
Sure. There were 10 separate techniques, and some of them were comparatively minor. For example, one of them was called the attention grab, where an interrogator would grab the prisoner by the shirt and give him a shake and yell at him. We can all argue that that's not torture, but that's really not what this debate is about. This debate is about three or four of the most serious, the most severe techniques. Now, the obvious one that everybody knows about is waterboarding, where a prisoner is strapped to a board with his feet slightly elevated, his head is immobilized, cloth is put around his mouth, and then water is poured on his face. Water gets up the nose and down the throat, and it gives you a sense of drowning. In fact, Abu Zubaydah almost did drown when he was waterboarded. His heart stopped. He had to be revived. On another occasion, he had seizures. He went into convulsions. So this is a very serious technique. But there were two others that I've always argued were worse than waterboarding. One was sleep deprivation. We know from the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association that people begin to lose their minds around day 7 with no sleep. They begin to die around day 9 with no sleep. But the CIA was authorized to keep people awake for 12 days. I think that's worse than waterboarding, as bad as waterboarding is. There was another one called the cold cell, where a prisoner is stripped naked. He's chained to an eye bolt in the ceiling, so he can't sit, he can't lay, he can't get in any kind of a comfortable position. The cell is chilled to 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and then every hour a CIA officer goes into the cell and throws a bucket of ice water on him. We actually killed people using that technique. So I believe that that's also, you know, one of the worst ones. Another part of this debate that I think we ought to talk about, too, is the techniques that CIA officers used that were over and above what had been approved by the Justice Department. For example, we had interrogators threatening to rape prisoners' wives in front of them. We had interrogators threatening to kill prisoners' children in front of them. We had interrogators carrying out mock executions with unloaded guns, revving drills to try to frighten prisoners into thinking that they were going to drill into their skulls. Abu Zubaydah was placed in a coffin. He was in a dog cage for 3 weeks. In that coffin, they put insects in there with him because they knew that he had an irrational fear of bugs. So it's not just the 10 approved torture techniques. It's also these other techniques that CIA officers used that no one has ever been called to account for.
Now, Gina Haspel was not present during these episodes of torture, but she knew about them.
Well, you know, we're not really sure if she was present or not. We know that because she was chief of the secret site, we know that she was there during the torture of Abdurrahim al-Nashidi. We don't know if she was in the room. She's never said. She absolutely, positively had an understanding of exactly what techniques were being used. She had the final authority over those prisoners.
You had a nickname for her in those days, John. What was it?
We did. We called her Bloody Gina. And it was because she was so quick to run out to head that secret site. She was so quick to say yes when asked to oversee this awful program that she developed the nickname Bloody Gina. And, you know, may I add something, too?
Sure.
And this is just a little anecdote, but it's something that has stuck in my mind over the years. When I first was hired into the CIA, a CIA psychiatrist with whom I was friendly said something to me that was so important. He said, "God forbid that someday while you're on an operation, you're kidnapped. But if that happens, don't try to befriend the female kidnapper. It's the woman who's going to kill you." He said, "Befriend the male kidnapper. He might be the one to let you go." And it's because when you're dealing with sociopaths, and the CIA is chock full of sociopaths, it's often the women who are more brutal than the men. And from the very beginning, that's how I saw Gina Haspel.
John, you said that everybody knew that torture didn't work. You've written that's not even the issue. Lots of different things work, but was it moral or ethical or legal? I think not, you said. And then you said about Gina Haspel and people like her. I think they do it because they enjoy it. They torture just for the sake of torture, not for the sake of gathering information. That's a pretty heavy allegation.
It is. It is. But you have to think of it this way. If you know that you're not collecting actionable intelligence, or if you know that you're collecting so much information that it's impossible for your analysts to get through it and to figure out what's true and not true, why keep torturing? Well, you keep torturing because it satisfies your need to feel revenge. And I think that's why Gina Haspel did this. Not just Gina Haspel and many others. They did this not because they were trying to save American lives, not because they were trying to disrupt the next attack. They did it because it made them feel good.
President Obama kind of green-lighted torture in the future when he refused to prosecute any of the torturers. And you were the only CIA person to actually go to prison on the torture issue. And you went to prison because you blew the whistle on it. Can you talk just a little bit about that experience and the book you've recently written about it?
Sure, I'm happy to. Let me say one thing first about President Obama. First of all, you're absolutely right about that. And this is something that is grossly overlooked by the media. And that is that torture isn't permanently outlawed. It's not permanently banned. What President Obama did by signing the McCain-Feinstein Amendment was keeping interrogation techniques within the parameters of the Army Field Manual. That's great. But what's to keep a future president, like Donald Trump, for example, from just changing the Army Field Manual? And that brings back torture. And it can be argued, I would say that this is wrong, but it could be argued then that those changes are legal, thus making torture legal. You're right also, I'm the only person that's ever gone to prison having anything to do with the torture program, and it was because I blew the whistle on it. I've said before, I wear that as a badge of honor. I make no excuses. I would do it again. I might do some things differently. I might hire an attorney first instead of hiring an attorney after blowing the whistle and being reactive. But I'm glad I did it. And then while I was in prison, I wrote a book called Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison, which I'm proud to say has won a couple of awards already. I won the Penn First Amendment Award. I was just named as a finalist for the Forward Independent Book Awards Best Memoir of the Year. And then I also wrote a third book with Joe Hickman that I think is important in this context. It's really the definitive work on the capture and the torture of Abu Zubaydah. It's called The Convenient Terrorist. And we had a heck of a time getting it disseminated. Publishing it was easy, thanks to Skyhorse Publishing. They do a great job on books like this. But the CIA and the Justice Department tried so hard to get this book quashed. You know, we had things like, we had the offer of a cover story on Newsweek. Not only did we not get a cover story, Newsweek, in the end, backed off and said that they weren't going to review the book at all. And that was typical. People would call us and say, look, I know I was going to review the book, but I've gotten a couple of calls and I'm going to have to back off. Well, Glenn Carl, the former chief interrogator for the CIA, wrote a book saying how wrong he had been and how awful the interrogation program was. And the CIA did the same thing to him, where they called every reviewer, they called every magazine, they called every major news network and said, don't you dare review this book. So, you know, at least it's out there. And if people are looking for the definitive account of the hunt for Abu Zubaydah, the capture of Abu Zubaydah, and the torture of Abu Zubaydah, it's The Convenient Terrorist.
Oh, John, we would love to spend more time with you. I know you have to go, but let's have you back on to talk about your books in more detail. And really, kudos for everything you've done.
Oh, thank you so much. Listen, the pleasure is all mine. I'm happy to join you anytime you'd like.
Thanks.
And,
take care.
And, John, you've got a sure thing with us. Next time you write a book, we'll review it. Yeah, you take it easy.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Let's stand up. Thanks. Bye-bye.
We're joined now by attorney Katie Gallagher with the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Katie, we just spoke with John Kiriakou about this topic. We didn't, however, define what a black site is.
Sure. So, you know, in the aftermath of 9/11, I think it's important to recall how quickly the operations moved into a quote-unquote counterterrorism sphere. Of course, we had the military response in Afghanistan in October, but prior to that, President George W. Bush had authorized the CIA to engage in interrogation and detention practices. And we saw this manifest in a number of ways, including through the Extraordinary Rendition Program, where the U.S. sent individuals to other countries where the U.S. knew they had a record of torture, and they sent them there for the very purpose of being tortured. And so one example of that is the Canadian citizen Meher Arar, who was sent to Syria. We had individuals who were sent to countries where the CIA had a oversight role in what I would call proxy detention. So there are instances of people being sent to countries such as Jordan, where interrogations were done. And then there was the third example, and that's the CIA secret black sites. And these were detention centers set up in third countries, off the radar, off the map, and beyond the reach of the law, or so they hoped. And we now know that there were CIA black sites operating in countries including Thailand, in Eastern Europe, in Lithuania, Poland, and Romania, as well as in Afghanistan. So these were places that were intended to be beyond the reach of the law, where the CIA had suspects, and again, that's even a generous term, but they had individuals who they subjected to interrogation techniques that amounted to torture.
And the staff that would be engaging in these techniques were U.S. CIA personnel?
Yes.
Do you know if there were military contractors there as well?
I don't know that. I think there are questions about who was present in some of these locations, whether there were individuals from other government agencies. There were some government agencies, including the FBI and the Navy, who were less interested in participating in some of these activities than others. But in terms of the scope and the scale, and to your point about contractors, there is one obvious set of contractors that we know was involved, and that is Mitchell and Jessen, the psychologists who helped create the CIA torture program.
Katie, Gina Haspel, who is likely to become the new CIA director, oversaw President George W. Bush's rendition to torture program. And I think she was also in charge of a black site in Thailand. She's now being defended for her actions by people who are arguing that she's just following orders. When the Nazis were tried at Nuremberg after World War II, they defended themselves by saying that they were just following orders. Is this a valid defense under international law?
It is not a valid defense, but I'd just like to step back a little bit on what Gina Haspel's role is and was. You know, she has been the deputy director of the CIA for the first year of Donald Trump's administration. So I think it's important to remember that she's already had a significant role to play in whatever the CIA operations are. In terms of what her role was during the George W. Bush administration, there are many open questions. We know that she has been implicated in the torture program. How extensive, up to you use the word running, I'm not sure I would use, you know, where exactly the lines fall. And I think we, the American people, have a right to know what her full role was in the CIA torture program. We do know that she was present in Thailand and was chief of the base, the CIA black site in Thailand, at a time when a suspect, al-Nashiri, was subjected to acts of torture. And we know that she was present when he was waterboarded. There were instances of mock executions in late December of 2002. Whether she was the head of the base during that time, it seems so. But again, there are open questions. There has been some dispute as to whether or not she was present when Abu Zubaydah was subjected to waterboarding 83 times. She may not have been chief of the base at that time, but was she present? These are, again, questions. But she certainly had knowledge of the program. She approved of the program. And she's been praised by current members and former members of the CIA as someone who gets the job done, who is creative. And I think this is someone who is very scary, in my opinion, to have as the head of the CIA in a Donald Trump administration, when following orders may mean doing waterboarding and, quote, a hell of a lot worse, which is what he promised during the election.
Another defense is that at the time, torture was legal. California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein authored the report exposing the CIA's interrogation program, and she defends Haspel. She says she has been, I believe, a good deputy CIA director. And Feinstein stressed that the interrogation techniques, torture, was not especially illegal. How do you respond to that?
Well, I hope that Dianne Feinstein's position is not yet settled on this, because she knows a lot of what happened during the CIA torture program, and her support of someone like Gina Haspel, I think, is deeply concerning. Torture was not legal. Torture was not legal under U.S. law or international law. During the time of the George Bush administration, it is not legal now. And again, going back to Michael's question of following orders, this is a defense that has been rejected at international law level in Nuremberg, and it is not a valid defense under domestic law. It has, however, been an excuse for many former Bush administration officials, including George W. Bush himself. And I think we have to step back and remember the role that lawyers played during the Bush administration in what I would say was providing legal cover, or attempting to provide legal cover, for unlawful, illegal acts of torture. So no, this is not someone who should be heading the CIA. And again, I think it's quite dangerous to have someone like this heading the CIA when they think following orders to torture is somehow permissible.
Yeah, former CIA Director John Brennan has famously said, "We have to take the gloves off in some cases." Last week, he told an interviewer that, quote, "Don't forget that the interrogation program was authorized by the President of the United States and deemed lawful by the Department of Justice." How did the Justice Department arrive at the position that their interrogation techniques were lawful?
Well, what the lawyers during the Bush administration, including people like John Yoo and Jay Bybee, who's of course now a federal court of appeals judge, what these lawyers did is they sought to redefine what torture is under U.S. law. But they can't do that. The law is the law, and the U.S. Criminal Code defines what torture is. And acts that cause serious physical or mental harm of the type of subjecting people to mock executions, to waterboarding. I would say also to the fundamental rights violations of secreting them away in far-off bases, cut off from access to any form of due process, access to lawyers. There were no charges brought. There are many ways that the clear laws that apply both at the domestic and the international level to U.S. citizens were violated.
Yeah. No charges were brought against John Yoo. He became a professor at the University of California Law School.
Right. And so I think what we've had here is a massive accountability gap. Again, Dianne Feinstein oversaw a massive report that still has not been made public that looked at the CIA torture program. We've seen over 500 pages of a redacted executive summary that alarm bells go off, and it's a harrowing read, to be frank. And even Barack Obama acknowledged that, quote, we tortured some folks. But when it comes to accountability, whether under the Bush administration or under the Obama administration, and certainly not under current Attorney General Jeff Sessions, we've seen zero accountability, which is why we at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I really credit Michael Ratner and Peter Weiss as being visionaries 14 years ago, sought to look under the principle of universal jurisdiction for justice elsewhere, because it has not been forthcoming here in the United States. And the very risk of impunity is being realized now, and that's repetition. I think there is a great fear that when you have someone who participated actively in torture and has been able to, quote, get away with it, it empowers others to do it again, and it may allow her to do it again.
Katie, you mentioned El-Nashir and Abu Zubaydah. Didn't Abu Zubaydah lose an eye from the torture?
I believe the eye was lost at the time of his detention.
Mm-hmm. And is he still in Guantanamo?
Yes.
And what about El-Nashir?
Yes.
They're both still in Guantanamo.
Yes.
How many people in total, do you know?
I believe there are 41 men still in Guantanamo, including a number of men who've been subjected to the CIA torture techniques. And I would again say that being held for what is now in many cases 14, 15, 16 years in detention without charge constitutes a form of torture, because it is, if not the physical harms that they were subjected to earlier in their detention, the ongoing mental harm of not knowing what their fate will ever be is problematic.
It's extraordinary that these men are still there.
Trump has said that he wants to bring back waterboarding and, quote, a hell of a lot worse. Attorney Vince Warren, the executive director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, last week wrote a Guardian editorial. And he said in the editorial that we're on the brink of a full-throttle return to officially sanctioned U.S. torture. Do you think that Haspel's record is unlikely to destroy your chances in the Senate of being confirmed as the new CIA director?
I can only hope that her record will prevent her from being the CIA director. I hope that we have members of the Senate who are willing to put the law ahead of politics, and who recognize that the danger of putting someone like Gina Haspel at the head of the CIA. I think what is notable, again, is how many people from both parties or CIA agents from different administrations have come out in support of her, which I think raises serious questions about what the atmosphere is in the CIA and what the CIA's role is envisioned to be. Because if someone who has been implicated in the U.S. torture program is considered the right fit to head that organization, then that organization is rotten through and through.
She not only participated, but she destroyed the videotapes of the torture techniques.
Yes.
New York Senator Chuck Schumer, who's the Senate's top Democrat, is not calling on his fellow party members to oppose Trump's nomination of Mike Pompeo, the current CIA director, who's to become the Secretary of State. Pompeo has indicated that he is open to the reauthorization of torture. He referred to the CIA agents who waterboarded people as patriots. Is there any reason for you to believe that many Democrats will not oppose Gina Haspel?
I don't have reason to believe that many will not oppose her, but I do think we as civil society have some work to do to ensure that they do. It raises questions about what certain members of this administration see the CIA's mission as. And of course, there are people within the CIA who are trying very hard to reform the practices, who are seeking to operate within the confines of law. You just had on a whistleblower. So I think the damage that can be done by putting someone like Gina Haspel in that position really can't be understated. And I hope that there may be some pressure not only from civil society and Americans reaching out to their members of Congress to voice their opposition to her nomination, as well as Pompeo's for state, but maybe also on the international front, where partner organization of CCR, the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, last year put in a dossier in Germany asking that an arrest warrant be issued. So I'd like to see progress there and maybe some pressure coming out of Germany or Europe, because if you have a CIA director who can't travel for fear of arrest, is this the country that we are? And of course, another big potential form of accountability is looming, and that is at the International Criminal Court, which is poised right now to open a full investigation into U.S. activities on the territory of Afghanistan, as well as on the territory of states' parties, including Poland, Lithuania, and Romania, that had a connection to crimes on Afghanistan, and they are specifically naming the U.S. torture program. So I do think that there is some international eyes on this, even if we don't yet have a clear sign that the Senate will reject her nomination.
Katie, what are your thoughts on the fact that the government got away with and continues to get away with torture? Do you think it has anything to do with the fact that many Americans might support torture?
Well, those statistics go up and down. It's interesting. Certainly prior to 9/11, the vast majority of Americans, it would have been inconceivable to say you support torture. And then we saw a rise, and then we saw a fall. And I think we're now at a point again where you have far too many Americans supporting the idea of torture. But I think we have to look at that in a larger context. It is not only the CIA Black Site program. It is not only Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, though those are horrific examples of U.S. torture. But I think it's the larger context we have in this country at this moment. We had Stephon Clark, an unarmed 22-year-old black man shot dead in his backyard. This is something that we read about in the papers all too often, and there is no accountability. What we read about in the criminal justice or injustice system, what we know goes on in U.S. prisons, what we hear out of the Department of Justice and, frankly, from the current president of the United States that is supporting an anti-black, white supremacist, in many cases, agenda is deeply concerning. It's again, horrifying. So I think to look at that support for torture, we have to also look at what we have come to accept in terms of impunity, in terms of racism and othering here at home. And so I think we have a lot of work to do on many fronts.
What can our listeners do to oppose Bloody Gina's nomination?
I think the first thing is to speak out, and that includes, of course, contacting your members of Congress. I think it means sending letters to the editor, to the newspapers where you have former CIA officials coming out in support. I think it's educating yourself about what her record was, and to the extent that we don't know, and there are certainly we don't have the full picture, I think it's again demanding that we, the American people, know what was done in our name, demanding transparency and making clear that returning to torture is not what they want.
And how can listeners learn more about your work and the Center for Constitutional Rights?
Sure. They can look at our website, ccrjustice.org. We have some actions and events listed there, and we have some information about our torture accountability work on the website.
You know, before we say goodbye, though, Katie, and if you don't mind, a personal question, how did you get involved as an attorney, you know, in this kind of litigation? What was the path you followed to the CCR and now litigating torture cases?
I studied in college, and then in graduate school, I focused on the Middle East. And so I spent some time in that region. I was very lucky to spend a year in Syria with the amazing warmth of Syrians, which is just devastating to think of where the situation is now. Spent time in Israel, Palestine, and in Egypt. And through those experiences in the early 90s, came to have a very different viewpoint of what U.S. power and colonialism in different forms can bring, what U.S. militarism can bring. So out of those experiences, I went to law school at CUNY Law School, where I had as a professor Rhonda Copeland, a longtime Center for Constitutional Rights attorney. She was a mentor to me through law school. And so I started to intern with CCR back in the late 90s. And then I went in and worked in The Hague at the War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia for a number of years, and brought back to CCR. I was very lucky to have the opportunity to go to CCR and bring back with me some of the knowledge I had gained as doing war crimes prosecutions. And so, again, was very lucky to work with Michael Ratner and Peter Weiss as they were embarking on the universal jurisdiction work. And so I've carried that work on with a large network of partners internationally in different fora over the years.
Katie Gallagher, it's always a pleasure to have you on.
Keep up the good work in your litigation at the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's really a pleasure for Heidi and I to have you on Law and Disorder, and we hope to have you back with some good news about Bloody Gina. You take it easy.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Katie. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild filed a lawsuit in Brooklyn on March 15th. They aimed to block Trump's cancellation of temporary protected status that had been granted to more than 50,000 Haitian refugees because of the deplorable conditions in that country since the hurricane of 2010. The Immigration Project declared Trump's actions to be unlawful, racially motivated, and evidencing a complete lack of knowledge of immigration law. The TPS program exempts from deportation people from countries in turmoil due to war, natural disasters, and other extraordinary conditions. The suit alleges that the federal government was, quote, arbitrary and capricious in its decision to end the program and was motivated by Donald Trump's, quote, racial and national origin animus towards Haitians. It cites Trump's demeaning remarks toward Haitians and Haiti. He has said that Haitians have AIDS and Haiti is a, quote, shill country. The Trump administration's position is that protecting Haitians is no longer necessary because conditions there have improved. Here to speak with us today is National Lawyers Guild attorney Sejal Zota. She's with the National Immigration Project of the Guild, with offices in Boston. The Immigration Project is a national nonprofit organization providing technical assistance and support to community-based immigrant organizations, law practitioners, and advocates seeking to advance the rights of non-citizens. Zota taught at the University of North Carolina School of Government. Before that, she was an instructor at the Immigration Rights Clinic at the NYU School of Law. Sejal, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You recently made a statement to the press denouncing what you called the Trump administration's, quote, about face on TPS. Do you think Trump has a discriminatory agenda to reduce the number of Haitians in the USA?
I do. I think that the decision to rescind TPS status for Haitian immigrants is clearly racially motivated. And I think that Trump has been pretty blunt about that. You know, just to give you some examples, last year in June, when he learned that 15,000 Haitians and 40,000 Nigerians had received visas to enter the United States, you know, the president exclaimed that all Haitians have AIDS. And upon seeing the United States, Nigerians would never return to their huts in Africa. You know, at the beginning of this year, when he had a meeting on immigration reform with several U.S. senators and former Secretary of State Tillerson, you know, he said that Trump said he didn't want immigrants from African countries, which he derided as shithole countries. And, you know, and when they were talking about a proposed immigration plan, you know, he expressly said, why do we need more Haitians? And said that they should be excluded in any proposed immigration plan. And in contrast, he stated that immigrants from countries like Norway were more desirable and should be admitted. And, you know, and Dick Durbin, Senator Dick Durbin, you know, pointed out during the meeting that president's singling out of Haitians for exclusion was an obvious racial decision. So I really think it's there in Trump's comments. You know, the last thing I just want to note is that in April of last year, DHS, you know, when they were trying to figure out were they going to extend TPS for Haitians, DHS sought crime data on Haitians with TPS, as well as information as to how many Haitian nationals were receiving public benefits. You know, they did this even though most criminal convictions will render a TPS applicant ineligible for the benefit, and TPS holders are not eligible to receive welfare benefits. And I think significantly the review of these factors, it doesn't fall within the statutory criteria that Congress has laid out, you know, which governs TPS extensions, but it is consistent with Trump's bias. And I think this sort of gambit, it really sort of trades on these faults anti-black stereotypes about criminality. And it really suggests that they were, you know, trying to manufacture a public safety rationale for the planned termination.
I understand that the administration reported on conditions in Haiti. Can you describe what they found, and have these conditions improved?
Well, last May, they did extend TPS for Haiti. You know, I just want to back up because I don't know how much your listeners know about Haiti's situation, but, you know, in January 2010, one of the deadliest earthquakes in the history of the Western Hemisphere struck Haiti. It was a 7.0 magnitude earthquake, and it, you know, threw this fragile nation into chaos, and it killed around 200,000 people, and it displaced more than 2 million people from their homes. It caused an estimated $7 billion in damages in a country with a GDP of only $6.6 billion, right? So it was this catastrophic thing. And then since then, Haiti's experienced one of the most severe outbreaks of cholera that was introduced by UN officers that came to help out after the earthquake. And it's experienced Hurricane Matthew in 2016, which was the strongest hurricane to hit Haiti in more than 50 years. So that's kind of the backdrop of what Haiti's been through. And then last May, DHS found that the conditions for which TPS is in effect, that they remain, making it unsafe for Haitian nationals to return, for Haitian TPS holders to return. And they, you know, they specifically cited to the ongoing cholera epidemic, stating that close to 800,000 Haitians had contracted cholera and nearly 10,000 people have died. They pointed to Hurricane Matthew, the more than 500 fatalities that Matthew caused, and it, again, sort of exacerbated the housing crisis because it left another 200,000 people without housing. It hit one of Haiti's key food-producing areas, so it also caused damage to crops and livestock, infrastructure, and again, exacerbated the food insecurity that was already there based on, you know, due to the earthquake and floods and droughts. So the administration noticed that there are more than 3 million people who face food insecurity. You know, and then the last factor I'll note is around the housing crisis. The administration found that while 96% of people had moved out of internally displaced person camps, that there were still 55,000 people in those camps where they remain vulnerable to gender-based violence and other risks. But they also acknowledged that, you know, even people who are no longer in the camps, you know, they've moved back to unsafe homes or settlements that are in hazardous areas. And, you know, one example of that is Canaan, where in Haiti, it's a settlement, an informal settlement created shortly after the earthquake. And there are, I think, upwards of 200,000 people who live there. And, you know, and the people there, they lack access to basic services like water and waste management, health care. So those are the conditions that the administration cited, too, back in May. You know, that said, the Haitian government has, you know, has made a lot of progress in reducing the number of cases of cholera. You know, in 2017, Haiti finally elected a president and a full parliament for the first time since 2012. So things are progressing, but overall, the extraordinary conditions remain that prevent nationals from safely returning today.
Attorney Sejal Zota, you're the legal director of the National Immigration Project, and you have individual clients, Haitians, who are here in the United States. And can you tell us about some of them and what they've accomplished here, what might happen to them if they're thrown out?
Yes. DHS's decision impacts 50,000 Haitians who come next July are going to lose their status, they're going to lose their work authorization, and they're going to be here present in the U.S. unlawfully. And it means that they're going to have to go, you know, 50,000 Haitians and their 27,000 U.S. citizen children and their 5,000 U.S. citizen spouses are going to have to go, you know, they're going to be faced with the decision of going back to Haiti, a country that just is not prepared to receive 80,000 people. And, you know, in terms of our plaintiffs, a number of them have had children born in the United States. You know, they've married in the United States. And so this is going to risk separating Miss Florial and Miss Belliard and, you know, Miss Jean and Mr. Pierre from their U.S. citizen children, right? They're going to be faced with that heartrending decision of whether to bring their children to a country with harsh and unsafe conditions or to leave them here in the care of someone else. For the sake of their own futures and physical safety, but separated from their parent. I mean, as a parent, I don't know how one makes that decision. You know, another one of our plaintiffs, Mr. Saget, he has cerebral palsy. You know, prior to the earthquake, he lived with a paid caretaker in Haiti. But his caretaker died in the earthquake, and he had no remaining family in Haiti. And fortunately, he was able to join his brother here in the United States, who's a U.S. citizen. He now lives with his brother, who's a registered nurse and who cares for him. But if Mr. Saget, you know, is forced to go back to Haiti, he'll have no one to care for him, to care for his personal medical needs there. You know, we also represent Haiti Liberté, the largest Haitian newspaper distributed in the U.S. You know, if this decision stands, you know, one of their leading writers will be forced to return to Haiti. He's exceedingly difficult to replace because he's skilled in both French and Creole, and is one of a handful of people that's able to write about the current events in Haiti. I believe he contributes 10% of their articles currently.
Sejal, I want to ask you about the lawsuit that the National Immigration Project recently filed and that you've referred to. It seeks to block Trump's cancellation of TPS that had been granted to more than 50,000 Haitian refugees. What other organizations are working with you on this lawsuit, and where is it procedurally? I guess it was just filed.
Yeah, it was just filed last week, and so the next step will be for the government to answer, but they get, you know, up to 2 months to answer, and you know, they may seek an extension. So we don't expect anything in the immediate future. You know, the other groups that we've been working with, you know, one partner is Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. They've been a key player supporting the suit. They're based in Boston. They're a partnership of Haitian and U.S. human rights advocates working to implement a just and democratic government in Haiti and to uphold the rights of Haitian nationals living here in the U.S. They've been advocating around Haitian TPS for years, and they were pivotal to getting so many bipartisan political leaders to demand that Haiti's TPS should be extended. You know, in terms of our suit, they were deeply involved in plaintiff identification and strategy. You know, we've also worked with the New York University School of Law Global Justice Clinic. They put out a report on conditions in Haiti at the end of October last year, you know, right before the administration's decision came down to terminate TPS, and we've really relied on them as subject matter experts as to conditions on the ground. You know, their report is incredibly helpful. The primary author is Ellie Happel, and Professor Margaret Satterthwaite is the editor. And then in terms of counsel on this, you know, the suit, we're working with the law firms of Kurzban, Winger, Tetzeli, and Pratt in Miami, Mayer Brown, you know, which is a nationwide firm, and then the law office of Correll Sirique in Miami.
Can you talk briefly about how the new policy, the Trump policy, violates Haitians' due process rights?
Yeah, so, you know, if you look at the immigration statute, it requires, it mandates that TPS be extended if the conditions underlying the designation continue. The statute's very clear about that. And based on a review of those conditions, the earthquake and its recovery, the cholera epidemic, you know, the impact of Hurricane Matthew, the predecessor secretaries of the Department of Homeland Security, they've extended TPS, right? Even this administration initially extended TPS. And so Haitians here in the United States, with TPS, they've relied on the statute. They've relied on that statutory process, you know, the standard that's been used. And, you know, meanwhile, they've been reading about conditions back home. And they've relied on the fact that they wouldn't be forced to go back to a country that's not safe, right? So they've lived their lives here. They've had kids here. They've opened up businesses. They've decided not to immigrate to other countries. And this administration, by looking to other criteria, by following a different process, you know, we take the position that they that doesn't comport with due process, and that they employed an invalid and unauthorized process in terminating TPS for Haitians.
Sejal, on a personal note, if we might, how did you get involved in this kind of work?
So I am the child of immigrants. I've always had a personal connection to the work. Firsthand experience the contribution of immigrants, the sacrifices, the xenophobia. So this work has always called out to me. I also went to law school right after the draconian 1996 immigration laws were passed, and there just was a real need to fight and push back against those laws. I just had this clear path, and I've been involved in this work basically ever since law school in various capacities.
And how can our listeners learn more about the Immigration Project and this lawsuit in particular?
Well, we'd encourage them to go to our website, which is www.nationalimmigrationproject.org. We have, you know, lots of information there about the work that we do, our cases, our advocacy efforts, our publications, as well as community and attorney resources. But we also have the lawsuit and our press releases up. You know, we publish notifications about the lawsuit on our website. You know, if people are interested in join, you know, we're a member-based organization, and if people are interested in joining our organization, we also send out periodic newsletters and emails about the progress of our cases. And so that's another way that folks could specifically learn about the case. But I'm always, you know, if people want to reach out to me, I'm always happy to let them, you know, talk about the suit, let them know where we're at.
Well, we are fans of the National Immigration Project. You do tremendous work there, and it's been really a pleasure to speak with you, Sejal.
Thank you, Sejal.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you come, great you come show. Back on when you win this lawsuit.
Exactly.
We'll talk to you then.
Okay.
Take
you
care.
Take it easy.
That's a deal. All
okay.
right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Next week, we're going to interview Eli Smith, the organizer of the upcoming Brooklyn Folk Festival. American folk music is really people's music. It's non-commercial, like our stations. The Brooklyn Folk Festival will feature 40 bands, workshops, jam sessions, a square dance, salsa dance, a fiddle contest, rare film screenings, and a return of their famous banjo toss competition. The Folk Festival will be held on April 6th through April 8th at St. Anne's Church at 157 Montague Street in Brooklyn, New York. Advance tickets are on sale and can be had at brooklynfolkfest.com. That's the Brooklyn Folk Festival, April 6th through April 8th, St. Anne's Church, Brooklyn. See you there.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Somebody else, she's sleeping with somebody else when the sun goes.